Okay, so this is Unstandardized English. I am your host, Dr. J.P.B. Gerald, and we talk about the racially, linguistically, and neurologically minoritized on this show. If you don't know what that means, just keep listening. But basically, we talk about aspects of racism and aspects of other forms of oppression and whatever else I want to talk about, and sometimes ADHD because I have it. Today, I'm going to talk to my friend Seth Ligo. He's a professor, and we're going to talk about pop science. You know, academics or scholars who write for the public, but they sort of take all of the expertise out, or they say things that are just not true. And because of their credentials, they're taken really seriously, and it could be really dangerous. But on the other hand, we can't just write in journals, and I talk about that a lot. So we're going to talk about pop science and the value of it and the danger of it and so forth. And also, I finished the manuscript for my first book, for my second book. I told you that already. And well, I'm getting closer to getting it published. I now know that if I can get this to the publisher in March, it'll come out this year in September. And that's a lot faster. So that's cool. All right. Enjoy the episode.
Here. What I wanted to talk to you about today is that we sort of sprung from a Facebook conversation we were taking part in, right? It was about Harari, right? That's his name.
Yeah, it is.
And you know, you can explain in a second because you're more I'm aware of him, but you're more familiar with his nonsense. For those who don't know, he wrote the book Sapiens, and he's written, I guess, a sequel, which when you think about what Sapiens is supposed to be, I don't know how you can write like that's supposed to be everything, right? Like when you think about it, right?
Yeah, I think that the sequel is called what, Homo Deus? It goes into the future and it talks about humanity becoming its own sort of god or its own superhuman superstructure. I'm not sure. That one I'm not as familiar with. I think he just released a new one called like Nexus or something a couple days ago, which talks about big data and what can be done with information and the sort of worship of information as a way to sort of asymptotically approach truth or reality. So he's got some other stuff out there. But yeah, we're talking about Sapiens. What drew your attention there?
I mean, you know, I've been so I started my doctorate in 2018, right? And I was a language teacher for however many years. You know, I taught in Asia, came home, and I was teaching in like sort of really contingent, like adult education jobs for a while. And I got a nonprofit job. I still work in nonprofits, but I'm like a director now. But like I was just a person at a nonprofit 10 years ago. But I was still doing language education. And when I got a job after that in curriculum development, which is closer to what I do now, the job I had was affiliated with with CUNY, right? City University of New York. So I got a discount on CUNY schools, right? So I applied for the education doctorate, the EdD at Hunter. And I got in and I got a discount. Not that much of one, but Hunter's also not that expensive, so it was okay. So anyway, I didn't go in there thinking like I want to write about inequity. I always found it interesting, but that's like I don't want to focus on this. But then like when I was trying to write about language in general, I was trying to write about English teaching because that's what I used to do. I kept running into inequity as like a subject, you know? And so anyway, as I started writing about that, I wrote about it, and I part of the reason it took me so long to go back to get a doctorate is that I was not certain I could write in sort of a traditionally academic way, right? I said, I can't do that. Like, so if I have to do that to get the degree, I can't do it. And then I did well in school, and I realized that I could write the way I wanted to write in a sort of more conversational way that I tend to write. It's still academic. I got my citations and all that, but I just mean in the sense that like, you know, I think that there's not much point in something being written if it can't really be read, you know? So I've always been thinking about how do we find that sort of balance between like, you know, genuinely useful explication of data and findings, and like, you know, nonsense. Because like, I fully understand why a Harari or a devotee of his work would say, okay, he's saying this, but you're all writing inscrutable stuff in journals. So who are you to tell me that what his work is useful if there's something that's useful in there, even if some of it's wrong, is that more valuable? And like, I can say why that's wrong, but I understand why someone might say that.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think, I mean, we need more conversational writing. We need more discourse, or at least an invitation to not be talked at, but, you know, sort of talked with or guided through information. I think that that's necessary in all sorts of writing. Journalism has done that very well in places in the past, longer form journalism. Now, I don't know, it feels like it's 50-50 advertisement in column form and maybe some bits of journalism thrown in there. The humanities used to do an interesting job of these sort of grand narrative, tales that they would talk about humanity. Of course, by that, they usually meant, you know, how did we end up in Virginia from coming from Athens, Greece, right? That was usually the limit of that arc and trajectory. So now we're trying to figure out, now we got more information. We're going to get better answers and way better stories, but how do we tell them in those ways? Yeah, I'm glad that you found a place for your voice and for your conversational writing. I think that the academy should be that kind of place. In fact, in every single course I teach, their midterm paper has to be in a conversational style. It has to be explaining to someone why they think something that we've been talking about is interesting or worth knowing something about or worth challenging or, you know, disagreeing with or pushing back against, but always with an either, and I tell them you can have a literal conversation partner. You can call your parents, talk to a roommate, explain something to someone who has ostensibly no background, but has the ability to understand English, or whatever language you're speaking in. Some of these students actually jump back into other languages for these conversations, I'm sure. But they would be able to then know more than they did at the beginning of the conversation. And that helps them start to think about the limitations of any kind of written project, and what they can actually do. So by the time they get to their final paper, they're not trying to write, since the beginning of time, humans have kind of openings, which are never gonna get you anywhere interesting, and are gonna have to be wrong for the sake of brevity, which I think is what we're seeing with Harari. So yeah, and I would also say, just to tap on something a little bit to the end of that, and I'd love to hear what you think about this. This idea that, sure, you can tell these stories, but in order to tell them in a way that can be understood by a wide range of people with a wide range of backgrounds, you necessarily have to abbreviate them or undersell them or in some ways reduce them in terms of their precision or accuracy to be consumable. I don't think that's the case. I think I would suggest that we need to frame our conversations better. And once we say, here's what I'm actually saying. I'm not saying anything beyond that. Here's a unit of stuff. If you want to read more, here are all the different directions you can go. I'm saying this thing. I think we could do that. I think we can do that in humanities. I think we can do that in the sciences. I don't know. What's your take there?
I mean, when I think back to when I first started teaching in South Korea, I was like 21 years old, right? And it's at this point, mm-hmm. and it's silly. It was like 16 years ago, right? And yeah. So, like, I remember I didn't know what I was doing. I had no mm-hmm. idea what I was doing, right? And, like, I didn't have to take this course, but I'd taken a little, like, training course at some shady little school in like Koreatown that doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And by taking the course, I would get $200 extra a month. The course cost $1,000. So yeah. After 5 months, it paid for itself, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then I was there for a year. So I was like, all right, I get an extra, like, you know, $1,400, right?
Why not?
You know, sure, right? But then I was there for 2 years. So it did end up being a couple extra $1,000, right? So anyway, the only thing they taught me there was how to basically make a lesson plan. Which is the easiest part mm-hmm. of teaching. Like the actual, like, I'm going to choose that this will take 10 minutes and this will take 20 minutes. Like, it's just a schedule, right? You know?
Right,
I'm not saying it's easy to know how long things will take until you do it, but, like, all it was like, writing down a lesson plan, basically, mm-hmm. right? And so much, unfortunately, and I'm getting sidetracked, but let me focus, but I'll get this point, is... And we want to go to like an education conference. And my degree is in education. The conference I go to are specifically education based. Like, so many of the presentations are just like, here's how you can make a lesson plan. I'm like, why do you need help with that? Like, you can just get a lesson on the internet. Like, that's just not even hard. So anyway,
yeah.
The point I'm making is when I was in Korea, when I was 21, I didn't know what I was doing. And like, there were very few English books I could get, right? There was a bookstore and they had like an English section. Right. So I was go to this English section to buy a book because like I learned pretty quickly that once I made a bunch of lesson plans, I was teaching the same class all week. I got taught the class 21 times. So by the end of it, I was pretty bored. And once I realized I made like 30 lesson plans, and then like they lasted me like the year. And so by like July, because I got there in February, in July, I was like, I don't have any planning to do. And when I wasn't teaching and sitting in the office, like, what am I going to do? I needed a lot of books. And I would buy, and the first pop science thing that I bought was like, I think it was Blink, right? The Malcolm Gladwell, right? And I was so impressed, right? I thought, look at these insights, right? I can't believe that I haven't, you know, come across that. And I thought I was so intellectual for consuming this, right? And like, I've obviously read the debunkings. I don't know if you know the podcast, If Books Could Kill, that's come
No, I
out.
don't.
Oh,
Yeah,
yeah, it's
I
a
don't
good
know it.
one. They basically pick up like, for lack of a better word, airport books. Airport nonfiction books and debunk the nonsense, right? So they did Blink. They've done some things that have gone on to like be sort of conservative things like San Francisco, right? And all this stuff, right? But because they're nonfiction, they can debunk the facts in them. They're not all like conservative crank stuff because like Blink isn't necessarily a conservative thing, but they go anyway. Every other week, it's on Thursdays. And I, you know, really thought that that's what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be a writer in some capacity, but I didn't know what that meant. Like, you could be a writer and you could just write in a corner, and that's fine. I didn't know what it would be. So, years later, right, because that was when I read Blink was probably 2009. And then he's got other books. He's got Tipping Point, you know, and then he had Outliers. By the time I was Outliers, I was like, he's just doing the same thing. I was just like,
That's not, I mean, high publishing academic-ish world people, you'll find a lot of what we call copy-paste reproduction, right? Where you're citing, it's not plagiarism because you wrote it originally, but it's kind of plagiarism because you didn't write it for this project. But yeah, no, I know what you're saying.
So once I got to that point, it's not that I thought that I didn't know enough to know how wrong some of the points he was making were, but I started to feel what was an unjustified, not unjustified, but I didn't have evidence for yet the fact that I could see through it. But I'm just like, something's wrong here, but I can't put my finger on it. Right. And then, you know, these books come out and I've read things that are better sourced, that are not trying to make grand claims. And I found those to be useful, right? When they stick really close to a small story that's like, here's this very specific thing I'm talking about. I feel like the less grand their claims are, the more valuable they can be. But people want answers to everything. And that's the hard part. So what do you even do? Right. And
That's, yeah,
so
that's going to be a great, you can sell that easily, right? This is relevant to every potential consumer because it is about the entirety of history. So yeah, but that idea of thinking, well, is this the story that one group of people tells, that one academic community tells, that one national perspective tells, and what other voices might be out there? And you can start to try to think about those. So what, yeah, what do we do when you can try to market these things and the appeal is not for this particular or the incremental? I think we need to collaborate. I think we need to be able to work together as academics. I think folks who are listed as collaborators in, STEM papers, that happens way more often than in the social sciences and humanities. I think we need to do more of that to not see our work as sort of a zero-sum game. Either I get credit or you get credit or no one gets credit. Let's just have no one get credit. But instead to say, wait, I need to know more about this field. I can do a little background reading, but what I really need is an expert working with me so we can combine our expertise and tell a story that would work for both of our potential audiences. There, we just doubled our audience, right? If you want to talk about it that way.
That reminds me of something that happened a couple of years ago for me, because like, so when my writing got a little bit more prominent in 2020 for cynical reasons, because I published my second article, which is about whiteness and English language teaching, the week that George Floyd was murdered. That was not a choice I made. That's
Yeah,
just
you can't choose when things go out.
when it came out, right? It had nothing to do with that, but of course, in that time, everyone's stuck at home, and every industry is like, oh my God, Right? And so they're looking for people in their industry who've said things. And I was talking about how the industry encourages whiteness and white supremacy as a sort of the way they use English as a proxy for it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And like, it was like a 7-page article, but then everybody wanted to talk to me. And I'm like, I'm not going to turn this down. It's a little weird that it's happening now, but if I turn it down, it's not going to happen again. So I did that. And part of the reason, and so that's part of how some of my writing got more popular. And then the following year, I was like, I have enough clout, I guess. I was still a student, but people knew who I was. I was like, I'm going to try to put a coalition together, as you know, across sort of language and language education, and we'll sort of talk about these issues and maybe put a conference on in a couple of years. It could be virtual, it could be in person, depending, right? So I got a bunch of people together, and we had a big call, and we had another call, and then like everyone was excited, and then like you know how academics are, they all get busy. That's fine. That has nothing to do with the topic. That's just you know how this is. But then what relevant to what we're saying is that there were people, and I was like, so here's my idea, whatever. And so I say, here's my idea. And somebody's like, well, technically, I'm a linguistics person. I don't actually study language education, so I don't know if I can give you that. Can we, the point is for us to collaborate. Like, I know we have different focuses. Can we just come together? And it just sort of fell apart because everyone was like, well, I don't know. I don't feel like I can step outside of my expertise. I'm like, I understand. I'm not asking you to be an expert in this other thing. I'm asking you to talk to me. That's part of why I do the show, which is not very popular per se. I'm not saying it's unpopular. It's just I'm not letting people listening to it because I'm always trying to talk to people who aren't in my exact discipline, you know? Because like, if I'm just trying to be, a lot of academics do this. I think it's the way we're trained. And I think that's part of the problem with the training is that like, we're only trained to talk in our little bubble of our industry, like our sub, 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 sub industry.
Yeah, that does absolutely happen. And I think it happens in different ways, maybe in some different fields. I get called on, I teach religion, right? Religions of Asia, which is one of those topics that is one of those times when, and we talk about this in our field broadly conceived, when, you say, what do you study or what or you teach? What do you teach? Chemistry, end of conversation, right? Or I teach history, American, cool, I like that. I like the Civil War, end of conversation, or something like that, or the history of the Civil War. But when you say religion, it's like, oh, I think religion is good, bad, wrong, right. I'm this, you're that. What's the truth, right? There's always like a different kind of next step. And I think we do sort of get pushed to be generalists more, maybe in certain disciplines than in others. For example, in those kinds of conversations, we have to like, try to root it in and say, well, actually, I focus on Hinduism and Buddhism and lived religion in northern India and parts of East Asia. And then the conversation usually ends at that point, right? A little bit
So they're
later.
like, okay.
But I spend a lot of my time working literally from the ground up just because of the nature of my audience, right? If I want to talk about Jesus, I don't have to explain who he is or where he was roughly from or the kind of impact he might have had on the world. But if I want to talk about Arjuna or I want to talk about even, I don't know, Dushasana, these characters who are known to billions of people across history, to anyone in my immediate audience. We do get more practice, I think, in certain fields. I think in certain fields, we do get more practice in trying to start from zero and to try to speak across some of those divides, in part because there's no one else in our bubble with us, right? Otherwise, we'd be talking to ourselves. So I don't, I think we do have some practice at that. We do have some practice at trying to get to these, important discussions and these detailed, specific, networks of information or clusters of information. And I think that can be applicable in other places too. Not necessarily assuming zero background or zero knowledge, but introducing topics in ways that show that just sort of perceived or received impressions are not necessarily the most helpful thing when we're trying to get into these conversations. I also notice I work a lot at Duke in particular. The majority of my students in my classes on Hinduism in India are of Indian heritage, South Asian Hindu heritage, in most cases. And they have an idea of a lot of the things I'm talking about, but don't have practice trying to articulate it. I've never been asked to describe what they're actually talking about or what they're thinking about. So I would say that, across these different audiences, we have these sort of these presumptions that we don't even know are presumptions. These sort of categories that we think we have filled or these terms that we think we have defined and we sort of move on. So all of this is to say, even if you're talking to an audience with a relatively shared background or sort of experience of being primed for a conversation, there is still plenty of room, even in just sort of listing the kinds of presuppositions to challenge them, right? You don't have to say, well, you know, again, to go back to the Christian example, I'm going to talk about this Palestinian social organizer from 2,000 years ago. His name happened to be Joshua, and some people thought he was God, right? I don't have to go that far back, but I can talk about the fact that his name was not Jesus historically, or that, you know, the ways in which we presume aspects or attributes of the systems that are derived from the narrative history of Jesus or of other religious figures to be clear, distinct, sort of finished, in the can, done. It's not the case. We can open those things back up. A lot of that is to say, yeah, that I think that we can come at conversations in ways that disrupt people and make them interested in the conversation, that don't exclude them, but also that don't, yeah, talk down, yeah, that don't exclude them or talk down to them and don't bore them, right? Just enough to get people interested and just enough to get them to think not only about the input that they might be getting from a written piece or a lecture, but also to be also like reprocessing stuff that they've already got going on inside as a result of that exposure. I think I answered in like seven different partial ways there. I also, the focus thing is a challenge for me. What else can I say to clarify what I said, or what else would you like to say?
Well, you know, I was following you. I have the same sort of, you know, roller coaster brain that you do.
Yeah.
So I was like, I see where you're going. You know, I think what you're saying, and I'm going to pull out something you said, and I can't remember how long ago it was, but it was in that poll about, different disciplines being trained more generalists and more specialists.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that part of the thing, to bring it back to Harari, and similar things and like Gladwell and whatever, is that like a lot of what I would say that in the sort of pop science book thing, right, the people who are seen not just like as a person writing a book, like a political commentator or whatever, which is a whole separate thing, but like someone who's seen as like, oh, here's an expert, is it's either history or it's like some kind of hard science,
yeah.
Right? Quote unquote hard science,
mm-hmm.
Right? So there's a person who can really explain something that someone's always been interested in, because like they're curious about chemistry, but they can't really understand it because they were taught poorly or it was complicated or whatever. Or it's history, and they're like, here's a history that I have not understood, or it's so comprehensive or whatever. And so there's something about those two aspects of expertise, subsets of expertise, that attracts publishers, right? And I can't fault publishers for that because people want to hear it, you know? And what I wonder is the solution – and I don't want to say, it's not going to be one solution, but is the way to address it to be to give, to really push, not publishers, but authors, you know, because like some of these books, they don't have citations. Like they have like, and like when I read, when I hear, I have such a, you know, training brain of citations that like I can't make a broad claim without citing it. Like I can make I know how to make a claim without citing it because I know how to couch it in like, this is my opinion and I'm only saying this about this specific thing and it's something that I personally experienced or whatever. Like I know how to say it when I don't, sometimes I'm just like, I can't go find an article for this. Like it's so generic. I can't be doing this, but like, I can't even do it, right? I can't do it. I can't say like I can't put numbers in something if I don't have a way to back it up with something. And
right.
I feel like some of these people, I don't know how they get over that impulse because a lot of them have training, like a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them have training. And then if you're Gladwell, you've worked with the New Yorker forever, however many years, like you may not have the training, but you have fact checkers.
I
just don't know how it gets through. You know?
Yeah. I mean, Harari is a historian, right? He did PhD or DPhil, I guess, at Oxford. And so he is one of those, he does have like the credential in one of those fields that, is supposed to be able to speak generally and accurately. I would say that no social scientist or humanities, specialist can actually do that. Also, no STEM or hard scientist, natural scientist either. I think it's interesting what you said, that it's either STEM or historians, right? Or natural scientists or historians. He opens amphibians by starting literally with, there were atoms and then molecules and then physics, and then physics made chemistry, and then chemistry made biology, and biology made history. Like, it's literally those four things in a row that he just lines right up there, right? So there's like, he has this idea that, that's what he does. He presents these as sort of inevitable. He uses short sentences that are declarative, that have no caveats. So you think that this is just what everyone must accept or assume, right? That first there was a big bang, and then there was no time and no energy, and then there was energy and time and matter, and then history. Right. And there's no other way to get to history. There's no other type of history. There aren't multiple histories. And of course there always are, or just had different ideas about like where the line is between even physics and chemistry. I'm sure that there are, philosophy of science folks who could still talk about that. So how do you get people to fact check? And then also how do you solve the things that aren't, history or STEM? So I think the fact checking thing, that's where you get the group of experts together, and maybe some of those folks start to collaborate with each other, and they say, okay, we've got someone who's a specialist in, there are anthropologists who study the evolution of the human body and can figure out a lot about who and what we are, based on human remains. And then there are also, you can get an archaeologist and you can get a sociologist and put them all together and get a really great story about what some humans did in one part of the world over a really long time frame. Or broad expanse of time. I think that would be one way to do that. You don't necessarily need to have someone, because you can find citations for wrong stuff all over the place, right? Like, my students are very good at this, unfortunately. They're bad luck. They happen to Google something, they find something that is well written and wrong, and then they grab it, right? Sort of like, they're almost AI engines at that point, right? They're trying to figure their own vetting process out. For example, BBC Religion, right? I would say like half the pages I click on there about Hinduism are well written, just as accurate as they can be for their length. And others are like, no, this is all misleading, right? This is actually going to derail, progress in understanding what we're talking about when we use the word Hinduism, for example. So I think we need to have those, but by collaborating, you would be able to avoid that problem. And how to make it interesting. Well, maybe it needs to be, maybe we need to have collaborations across these fields and into STEM and history, if those are the things that are appealing to people and seen as relevant. I'm thinking particularly right now about a series of studies that are taking place at Johns Hopkins about psychedelics and spiritual experiences. And they had a lot of great ways to measure what goes, like brain activity, dosage, even things about set and setting, which are less quantifiable, but more qualitative in terms of a controlled space, certain amount of light or brightness, different kinds of external, the possibility of producing different sorts of external stimuli. So they had all that controlled. What they didn't bother to do is talk to anyone who does religious studies or even anthropology or I think even like history, to talk about what is a spiritual experience, how do people describe them, what are we even talking about if we want to use the word spiritual, any of those things. And you can figure that out. It's never going to be perfect, but you can at least have a process for that. So what they ended up doing was using a definition, I think, from William James, which is over 100 years old, and is based almost entirely on Christianity and stuff Christianity has touched recently, right? So that's not, it's not exhaustive of what a spiritual experience can be. So there are for sure things that they're saying that wasn't spiritual when many people in the world today and across history would have called that what we've used the word spiritual to designate now. And then on the part of the problem with set and setting, bleeding in from that is that I think they also, they had a nice calm place with someone around so you wouldn't freak out but then they would also play Gregorian chants and choral music. Yeah, but like ecclesiastic, like Christian church music. I think like big organ built into something, stone music, which for some people would absolutely be conducive of generating a spiritual experience, but not for the majority of humans across history, right? So we again, those are very easy things to at least address. You maybe can't fix them. You just note them, and then you're back into a place where you can actually make, I would say, progress. And there are a lot of us out there looking for more work and with this training, and willing to make these, to have these conversations and to contribute here. Go for it.
Sorry.
No, you're good.
I think about IRBs, right?
Yeah.
And in order to get a school sponsored study, through the door.
Yeah.
Right. And brief anecdote here. when I was going through, I finished my comps, right? And they're like, all right, it's time to put your dissertation proposal together, right? Put it together. And like, they've been warning me, like, it's going to take months for it to get through the IRB. And so I submitted it and I went on with my life. I had some other project I was working on and I worked on it. And then I'm like, it's been a while. I went in and checked and it turns out that like, there was some clerical error in my submission, but it was not an auto notification thing. So I didn't get an email. I had to go in there and look. And I was like, I just wasted a month. And so I was so mad. And I went in there and I fixed it. And then it went through in like 3 days. I was like, I could have been doing this anyway.
Yeah, some of the fixes are small and we need to get rid of those and then actually deal with the stuff that's problematic. You know, like which open source teaching platform is flashiest now is not the question we need to answer. We need to answer what content can we get across and in what ways to make it accessible, right? That's two different things. Anyway.
So the thing about it is that like IRBs exist for a good reason, but what I've said this, and I don't remember whether I said this in the podcast or I've said it in some blog post I wrote. It's not in one of my articles, but so it's not published in a place you can cite. Although I guess you can cite a podcast, but I don't remember if I
Sure,
said
for
it in the
sure.
podcast or not. I say a lot of things in this podcast. I don't remember what I say, but
I don't remember what I've written in all of my articles. Sometimes I'm surprised. Oh, wait, that one went in this one. I thought, oh, yeah, it was going to go in that one and end up in this other one. That happens too, right? But yeah.
But I think that IRBs were created for a good reason because the schools were like, oh, we're doing some bad stuff. We need to stop doing this. So you need to submit your stuff to us so that we can stop you from doing bad stuff. But what is quote unquote bad stuff is stuff that, like, the most egregious stuff simply will not get through the IRB, and that's true, right? Like truly, truly,
You
terrible
can't
stuff
poke
will
little
not get
kids with sharp
through.
sticks, right? That exactly,
Right.
yeah.
But in terms of enforcing dominant ideologies,
Right, yeah.
the IRB only cares if the school is going to get sued or by the things like that. So like if
Yeah.
you are doing a study, and I think about my own fields that I've been in, both education and language, right? Or disabilities, because I've written about that too. Like, I think about there's this big discourse on the quote-unquote word gap that says that, parents of one class will physically speak more words to their children by a certain age, and that's why their children do better in school or something like that, right? And it's been debunked, but people still believe in it, right? And not even necessarily people who are being malicious. They just like they heard it somewhere,
Right.
right?
And it makes
I
surface
mean,
level
like
sense.
it
Why
makes
not?
logical sense, right? That's gonna any study to either replicate that or debunk it is gonna get through the IRB. And like the you get into this sort of quandary where like when I was in school, I was trying to make a point and my professor was like, you need to cite that, and I was like, yeah, but the evidence isn't out there yet. I wasn't making them a numerical point, I was just making an argument, right? And I was like, I know the evidence isn't out there, so there's not that much I can cite. And they're like, well, the evidence says this. I'm like, yeah, because that's what gets funded.
Yes. Yeah.
And I was talking about racism is the point, right? I was just
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
I was just like, no, but like if but like I can't. And so like then when one study comes out about that, it becomes a big deal, and then that's the only study. And I'm not saying those studies are bad, right? There's that study that came out that I think was led by Seth Gershenson that was about like the correlation between having literally one black teacher and black students having a higher graduation rate,
Yeah.
right? Like one
Yeah.
single black
Yeah.
teacher, right? And that was a big study in 27, published in 2017. And like, that was almost the first of its kind. I'm sure there's been some before that, but that was the one that people noticed because it was in CNN, it was in the Times and all this stuff, right? And so all these municipalities were like, well, we have to do something about this. I'm just like, I don't understand how you didn't know before. Like what did you
Yeah.
think was happening?
That is obvious as the more words you're exposed to means you use more words.
Right.
No, for sure. I think part of that specific issue to be a little bit off center here for a second is also just this idea that a lot of folks who are trying to notice problems within a system and fix them expect all the performance to be directed at them and not to be directed between different parties within the systems that they're trying to better engage, right? So yeah, you're supposed to show up and talk to us, we, the ones who are on the IRB, on the review board or whatever. You're not supposed to talk to each other and make things better where we can't see it. But back to the maybe with the more central topic. I think we can infinitely sort of regress there in a sense, right? So sure, even the people who are on the review board who are trying to fix problems, they also have their party line, their company line, their status quo, whatever the new thing is, even if it's a step in the right direction, there's always going to be that sort of does this fit with what we expect, with what we want, with how we see things? If it does, then it's legitimate. And if it doesn't, then it's invalid or not legitimate or less legitimate, right? So that's always, I think that we can't escape that. What we can do is get more voices in there and make that better and better. But we're still going to need to, at some point, be, yeah, so someone's going to have to sign off on something and they're going to have to base that approval on their own training and background. Right? So yeah,
I
again,
mean,
yeah.
it's sort of it's the catch 22, but that also takes the institutions off the hook, right? I'm saying it's a catch 22, but I'm just like, it's a catch 22 that people build, right? Like, it didn't just happen. You know,
No.
I just started teaching a class yesterday, right? For the new semester, and it's a class that's sort of, they're all special education teachers, but I'm teaching them about English language students, right? So that's interesting. So I'm talking about both language and disability, and you know, I can't not bring the racism into it because it's part of it. And like, one of the things that like they teach you when you're learning to teach, like just public school teaching, if you're learning a discipline, they will teach you only about this discipline, right? I'm not saying you can never learn anything else, but like, if you're learning for these people, they're teaching students with disabilities, and they've had however many classes on students with disabilities, right? And I'm not saying that's bad, like they should, but like, they're getting, now that they're in their master's program, they're all like first year teachers, they're in like the teaching fellows program, right? So they're first year teachers, and like, they're all learning some stuff about English language learners, and they haven't been taught any of that at all. And like, it's sort of seen as like a, here's this other thing. Don't worry too much about that. Here's this other thing, right? And like, and even in my doctoral program, which was admittedly a different angle because they didn't necessarily know what we were going to do studies on, right? We wrote an essay when we got in, but like, we had to
Oh,
take
yeah.
a wide range of sort of, here are some research areas to sort of determine what we were going to do. So that's fine. But like, I think that, and like, some of it's, you know, convenience, like you can only learn so many things in a few years, but some of it's also just sort of a really superficial way of approaching training new, and I'm speaking of educators, but it could be the same as scholars in some other way, and I'm not necessarily putting a line between those two words. And I just do think that like, it's almost like, it's really hard sometimes. The English language has so many words, but there's still only so many words, right? And what I mean by that is that like, it's really hard to read like a pop science book. And like, now because of my experience, I'm skeptical, but there are good ones. And like, the language isn't that different. There's usually just evidence for it, but the words aren't that different. And that's what's kind of annoying about it, because as I'm reading the book, I'm not checking the citations while I'm reading. I mean, I'll check later, but like, I just want to read the book. I'm not going to be like, oh, let me see what that says. You know what I'm saying? Like, I can't read that way if I'm just reading a book, not an article. You know, it's hard to read, and it just won't be fun.
That's true. Yeah, I wonder then if we need our like networks of accountability, where we have reputation, where we don't just have you can always find five people to praise any book and then cite them on the back of it. But if you are able to I don't know, trace the accolades and say, oh wait, this person liked that book. I liked what they did and I found it to be useful and accurate and reliable. I wonder if we can do it in some way, through association. Maybe I'm stating too much the obvious here. And back to that catch 22 thing. It's true. Maybe it lets people off the hook, but I would argue it also says we're saying like, don't think you finished, right? Like don't think you solved the problem. The problem is under need of constant review and address. Let's see. So I'm trying to think of examples now of collaborative work or of works with really remarkable scope that I think are successful. And there's one scholar who comes to mind before others, and that's Kimberly Patton, who's a professor at Harvard Divinity School, and she works in ancient Mesopotamian religion. I'm sure she would use a slightly different word for that, but she is she's able to bring teams together and get them to actually work together in ways that I rarely see in the academy. And again, I'm not talking about the natural sciences here. This is more history and the study of religion. But she writes comparative works on thematic issues across cultures and does it with the help of specialists in all of those regions who can then vouch for their own additions and also be vouched for by their respective communities. She's in a sense bringing all of those little bubbles in, together and lining them up so that you can move from one to the next if you so wish. I think there are other examples. There's a project I was part of that got published last year called Living Folk Religions, where there are scholars who talk about everything from American indigenous religions to contemporary. I talk about contemporary North Indian Hindu contexts. Some folks were talking about Norwegian metal bands and the religious organizations that seem to be following them around as folk revival movements, right? So there's this incredible scope historically, geographically, and in terms of authorship. But we don't really talk to each other there. That's just sort of a list. So I think there's maybe somewhere between those things that there are ways to take the next step in those processes to try to do this better. There's also what do you think? You're not enthused by that possibility.
I'm not enthused. I think it's a really good idea. I guess I'm just so cynical about it. And I don't mean, I'm not,
fair.
I use the word cynical deliberately instead of pessimistic,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm not mm-hmm. saying I don't think it can happen because it clearly mm-hmm. has, right? Mm-hmm. And clearly will again, right? Mm-hmm. The question will be like, if you are a publisher and in the state of publishing these days, right? And going forward, right? But honestly, it's not that different from 50 years ago. It's not like everything was better sourced 50 years ago, right? You know, so, you know, the like, here's what's true of all men and women 50 years ago was not.
No, but there are fewer written resources and fewer voices with access to say, wait, that doesn't include us, right? Or, yeah, there's right. less connectivity.
Right, they have less of an excuse now.
Right, fair, true, yes.
So, you know, when I say cynical, I mean, and I know you know what the word means, but what I'm, the reason I'm using it here is, like, what is the ultimate goal, right? I think I'm a teacher at heart. Mm-hmm. No matter what I do, I'm trying to teach, right? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to entertain, yes, but also like entertain in the service of education. And what I want, and not every scholar is trying to be an educator, right? Which is
no, not at all. And that's fine. They should choose, right? Yeah. Not want to do one and be forced to do the other. That does not turn out well. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. But I feel as though if you're trying to do what we're talking about, you should have some interest in education. Even if you yourself don't want to be a teacher.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I feel as though if you're trying to do this public facing stuff, you should want to be having an educational impact on the readers or listeners or whatever that you have. And so my problem is that like the, for lack of a better word, lay folks who are going to read this or mm-hmm. listen to this or whatever the thing is, like mm-hmm. nobody has a lot of time, and that's not anyone's fault, right? Like, and so, you know, you have to straddle that line between being complex and conversational at the same time, and it's hard. I think I do a good job, but I'm still, like, I think I'm doing a good job, but I'm doing a good job for an academic. So I'm still not quite as accessible as a regular person,
right?
Like I'm still writing in big circles and all of this. I'm just using less complex words. But I think that on this, like when I think about my own reading, cause I want to learn from a nonfiction book too, right? I want to learn, right? Mm-hmm. And like, I get into this quandary that I get into all the time, and it's really annoying, is that sometimes I find it hard to find nonfiction books to read. If, like, because either they're in a discipline that I know something about, in which case it's either an academic book, in which case it's like nigh unreadable, or it's a mass market book, and then I know most of this stuff. And I'm just like, well, all right. Because like
Yeah.
if I read a mass market book about racism, it'll be on page 150, like, here's what lynching is. And I'm just like, I don't blame the
Yeah.
people for that.
No, there's
But
a name
like,
for that. There are people who don't know, unfortunately,
right.
and yeah, they need to read that book. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. Either it's boring or you know enough to know that it's not accurate in some way, right? This,
Right.
yeah.
And so I get frustrated with that, but also I also know most people are not in our position where that would be the problem. So when I think about the people who aren't in our position with our training and our experience, I think about what could genuinely, you know, what's it, the zone of what's it, the proximal
The
knowledge.
Goldilocks, or what are you talking
Yeah,
about there? Yeah.
exactly. It's just like
Okay, yeah.
I want to get them slightly farther than from where they are.
Okay, yeah.
You know, zone of proximal knowledge, that's what it's called.
Gotcha, yeah.
And I just want to get them like I plus one. I just want to get them like a little bit past where they are.
Yeah, one more
And
step,
like,
yeah.
I think that that is a really, and that's not just a problem with publishing. That's a problem with just teaching in general. Not a problem, but just a challenge is
Yeah.
like getting people slightly past where they are and therefore activating what they already know. Because like, I'm not a, you know, empty vessel banking teacher, right? To talk about Freire and all that. You know, is a really thin line. And it's even thinner when you're writing a mass market book or, you know, any kind of mass market something, when you have no idea what everyone's line is.
Oh yeah. I mean, I would say that everyone's line is different, and that's
Well, right, yeah, that's the
part of the
point.
problem, right? And then the market there is that we all sort of assume that we know some things about. I mean, again, the Harari example, we know some things about humanity and evolution. We've seen something narrated by Attenborough and maybe something by deGrasse Tyson as well, right? We've got some stuff to connect to here. But I think we can, I don't know, acknowledge the fact that we have an entirely heterogeneous audience at all times. In my classes, I do. In my readership, I assume I do. In trying to talk to my family members and friends who are not part of my academic worlds or other academic worlds as you are, right? They're always coming from different places. So if you're asking what I think, I mean, if I have an idea of the things to do about this, I mean, I study what I study because I find it fascinating. The reasons I find it fascinating are I have to explain tons of context to talk about why I'm studying the exact thing that I'm probably going to read more about later today. But there are things that got me into this position, so I can remember my trajectory. I can at least find some things along that arc that are interesting. And I'm setting this up to put it in tension with what I see get a lot of circulation on social media. I'm plugged into lots of networks of folks who are scholars of religion, scholars of Asia, Asian cultures, anthropologists and ethnologists of Asia, and historians of religion and civilization in Asia, and then Asian communities both in Asia and in the diaspora. And the things that float around and get a lot of traction there are these sort of like ancient aliens, complete outside, like way outside even believability. But it gets the attention, right? And I sort of understand the idea of wouldn't it be great if we had proof that there was this amazing thing related to my culture, my background, my context that I can celebrate? And my response usually to those is, why are you making this stuff up? Like there is stuff there. Like there is stuff that is just as amazing or perhaps even more amazing, that could be discussed. So why invent new things that are going to be sort of like fantasy world building short and sort of little stubs of investigation or theorization? There are parts of stories that can grab people's attention. There are material traditions that can grab people's attention. There are questions about the world and existence and ways to answer them that can grab people's attention. So I want to continue to resist this idea that there's only certain things can be interesting, or there are only certain starting points that we can use to engage folks. I don't know how we identify those many different lines and how to help people take the next step, but I would hope that at least in, again, even if they know about the topic, that the way it's framed or addressed would be distinct enough to make them not angry and put the book down, but want to keep reading. And I feel like you do often. Either I know enough to think, well, this is wrong here, so why do I keep reading? Or I already know all this stuff. If I read something that I think I know in a slightly different way, that's more interesting. Yeah.
Well, I have to come to a close here, but I think one of the anecdotes I would bring up is that when I was teaching in Korea, I told you I didn't know what I was doing, right?
Yeah.
And my students, some of them would speak plenty of English to me. Some of them didn't know what I was saying. Mm-hmm. And you be in a class with people who knew exactly what you were saying and people who knew none of what, didn't understand what you were saying.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, mixed levels. And, you know, it's like 40 kids in a class. And so I'm standing in front of these people who, like, again, I'm 21. They're in high school. So they're like 4 years younger than I am. Mm-hmm. Right? And so, like, what is my authority over these people, right? You know, I'm not saying that the classroom is about that, but, like, why would they respect me?
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the things I learned is that a lot of the people I knew, because I was on a program, a lot of teachers, right? And, you know, we would talk to each other on, at the time, Facebook groups, because that was the way people talked to each other. And, you know, a lot of them would say that they would speak in what they considered sort of a pidgin English to speak to their students, right?
Yeah.
They say, like, I go to, you know, I'm not insulting people who are learning English and speak that way, but they would say things like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, like, I don't know. It's not that I had some grand philosophy. I said, but I think if I do a good job of framing it, they'll understand me. I probably used different words back then. I didn't know what framing was. But, like, I just said, like, if they miss some words but understand what I'm trying to say, it'll be okay. I never – part of it is that I can't do that. Even when I'm talking to – when I was talking to my son and he was a baby, I talked the same way. Like, I never did baby talk. And when I talked to seniors who were sort of losing their language skills, I still talk the same way. You know, like, brains can fill in the gaps. And I think that that assumption that they can't can be really harmful. And I think that that's what the problem is that we keep assuming – you know, we have to explain things well.
Yeah.
You know, and people who's like, well, we don't have to explain anything. Just read this journal. It's like, no. but I do think if we do a good job of explaining something, then we're clear, forthright, then no matter what the deep complexity of the issue, the language should be able to carry the day, is what I think. Should be. I say that like it's easy. It's not easy because the issues are complex, right? And we have to put a lot of caveats in there, and that's sometimes what makes people annoyed at us because it's just like, would you just say the thing?
No, I do with students. Are like, which part of this do I need to write down? Well, all of it technically, but I guess if we're going to just do that, this is where I stop talking to write the most recent thing down.
Right.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And everyone in the room would get a different amount of or a different depth of your message, right, in a given unit of speech, right, if they have different backgrounds or understanding. There's an example of this that I think is relevant to your point in the Smithsonian, in the Sackler, I believe it's in the Sackler, in D.C., and it's a set of mid-relief steles that depict four episodes in the life of the Buddha, and they're carved in what's now Afghanistan. So the way that they originally appeared, the birth of the Buddha is on the far right and the death of the Buddha is on the far left, because that's the way many scripts in that region run. If you look it up in archives, that's the way that they're photographed and presented. If you go and visit them in the Smithsonian now, they run the opposite direction. They rearrange them to a left-right chronological order. I think they think, to not confuse viewers, I think it's more important that viewers go, wait, why the hell is this running right to left? And am I reading this backwards and what's going on? Maybe that takes 10 more seconds of attention. Maybe not everyone's going to get it. But I think anyone who's interested enough to want to think about it beyond its physical, these objects beyond their physical appearance, or Buddhism is more than a label, would be able to get over that, right? Get through that, engage that, and learn something maybe new about Buddhism, like the fact that it was evident and present in what we think of as the Near East and parts of the Mediterranean a couple thousand years ago. I don't know. Does that align with what you're trying to say there?
Yeah, I mean, I think at heart we wouldn't do this if there wasn't an idealism within us. You know,
Okay.
if we didn't think people could learn and grow.
Yeah, but
Right?
we've seen
Yeah.
it happen. We know they
Yeah.
can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, because it's happened to us, right? You know, and I understand that there are scholars like you said, where they truly are doing this because they're interested. That's all they care about. They're just like, I'm interested in this thing. And that's fine. There's particular roles for which that is suited. Maybe just put them in the lab. You just stay over there. But the rest of us who need to interact with people and want to interact with people, I think we believe that people can really, really progress. And I think that if I didn't believe that, then what would be the point? So anyway, Seth, good to talk to you this
Good to
afternoon.
talk to you
I'm glad
too.
I got a chance to reconnect, and I think this will be a valuable conversation for the listeners. I'm glad to have had you here today.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and I look forward to listening to it and figuring out what in the world we were talking about. I will hope to cross paths with you digitally again in the near future. Take care.
Right, you too. Bye.